Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Focus Asia-Pacific from PCJ Radio International. The leader of Fiji's opposition National Federation Party says the suspension of one of his MPs until the next election is extreme and unwarranted, and a gross abuse of government majority. Last Friday, Parliament voted to suspend Tupu Drannudalo for the rest of the parliamentary term by 28 votes to 16. The vote followed a recommendation by the Parliamentary Privileges Committee, which is made up of four government MPs, after an incident last Thursday when the MP called the Education Minister an idiot and a fool. But Biman Prashad says suspending the MP until 2018 for such an offence is ridiculous. He speaks to Jamie Tahanaha.
What I understand from what happened was a very parliamentary exchange of ideas and also comments and accusations, and that's where the matter should have been left at, you know, and Parliament continues as it does in most decent parliaments.
And most decent parliaments, though, the level of decorum, should it go down to a shouting match where names like dumb natives, fool, idiot are thrown about?
Well, it depends on the circumstances in which those terms might be used. I mean, obviously, there are terms used in most parliament, which sometimes at the spur of the moment, and Honourable Drannudalo did say that and apologised in a contribution to parliament. But the fact of the matter is that the penalty, the suspension for the rest of the parliament's term is extreme and harsh, unwarranted and uncalled for in a parliamentary democracy such as ours. The whole issue should not have gone to the Privileges Committee in the first place. And obviously, the decision by four Fiji First members on the Privileges Committee to provide that kind of sanction to Tupu Drannudalo has been extremely harsh.
What does this mean for Ms. Drannudalo's job as an MP? She can't go to Parliament for 2 years.
Well, essentially, the people, it's not so much Honourable Drannudalo, it's the people who have elected her, people who have voted her, and the party that she represents, will miss that representation in Parliament. And that is the point. I mean, you know, when you look at penalties, when you look at sanctions, that must be within the ambit of a reasonable penalty, reasonable sanction. This goes beyond any reasonableness in meting out the kind of punishment that has been meted out to her through the Fiji First government and the majority in Parliament.
So what action can the party take? So you have tossed out the idea of the NFP leaving Parliament before. Is this something you're considering even more now, or legal challenges? What are your next moves?
As I said, those are options that the party will look at when it meets in a few weeks, and I'll leave it there.
A charity helping rebuild homes in Fiji says that while the necessary recovery from Cyclone Winston, that is, may no longer be hitting the headlines internationally, it's important that support continues. Habitat for Humanity is praising the effort of the Pacific-designed label MENA, which held a fashion show in Auckland to raise money for the charity's work in Fiji. Its New Zealand chief executive, Claire Zabel, talked to Joe O'Brien.
It's exactly the kind of support that we're looking for, actually. This is the wonderful thing about groups who have an understanding of what it's like to go through these natural disasters, and probably that's for us here in New Zealand too when we think about Christchurch. It's an event that is very striking in the news when it happens, but we know that the aftermath goes on and on for months and actually for years. And so in terms of the costs of the rebuilding and the reconstruction, those are all facing us still. Those emergency responses have been largely completed. People have been given short-term relief and temporary shelter, and there have been sort of repairs to homes. But the reconstruction is really costly, and it's a major exercise, and it needs groups to stay alongside Fiji as time goes on into the months and years, so that we can really make sure that not only do we build back, but we actually build back better and safer, and that people are going to be safer in the next cyclone.
So is that the stage where Habitat is at in terms of the rebuild in Fiji following the cyclone?
That's right. We are now looking at a major reconstruction effort. The government, of course, is subsidising a number of things, including building materials for families who've lost roofs or houses, and habitats, ensuring that when people get those building materials that they're actually applying them safely and they've got the right building techniques. So we're doing lots of training and support in the communities for that, but we're also helping rebuild cyclone resilient homes, and there's a lot of cost associated with that. So our fundraising is pretty critical at this time for Fiji.
And what is it that needs to be done to the homes to make them resilient to cyclones?
So there's a number of design features that I guess we've perfected over the years working in the Pacific. There's a lot about the foundations and how they are concreted in. There are considerations around the way the walls are braced. But most importantly, it's really about roofs. Roofs are the things that come off, and that's not only obviously destructive for homes, but they are incredibly dangerous when you've got roofing iron flying around and, you know, 300 kilometre an hour winds. That's actually often where we end up with a death toll. So there's a whole lot of safety issues around strapping the roofs down properly, and that's quite a lot of the training that we go out and do in the communities when we are doing our work.
Would you have an estimate of how many homes need that sort of work done?
We know that 31,000 homes were either destroyed or were significantly damaged in the cyclone. It's an enormous number. Some people will have been able to use the temporary shelter items that were distributed in the relief effort to largely repair those homes or those roofs. But there are still tens of thousands of homes that will need significant work, or else we just need to rebuild from scratch in many cases.
Drivers in the Solomon Islands will now face massive fines if caught drinking and driving under a new traffic legislation which came into force last week. Police are hoping the new law, which also gives them powers to carry out random breath tests, will help reduce alcohol-related traffic accidents and deaths in the country. Under the new laws, for the first-time offenders found with a blood alcohol level of 0.05% above will be fined $1,200, while the second-time offenders will be fined more than $2,000. In both cases, offenders will have their license revoked and could face 12 months in prison. The director of the National Traffic Unit, Paul Bulu, says he believes the severe penalties will be an effective deterrent. Paul Bulu spoke to Corey Hawkins.
Prior to this new legislation, we based our judgment on observations like when we see a driver, his eyes are red, he can't walk properly, he's talkative, his breath is heavily smelled of alcohol, and that's basically on observation.
This will provide a much stronger evidence base.
Certainly, yes.
And in terms of the implementation, I understand it came into force on the 1st of June. Like, are you already rolling out the traffic stops, or how are you going to implement the laws?
Well, at the moment, we're still waiting for some of our formalities to be endorsed before rolling out the program proper. But I'm hoping, or I'm looking forward to, not very long. Could be next week or week after.
The penalties, do you think the average Solomon Islander will be able to pay this, or do you think they'll just be serving the time of the 12 months under the laws?
Well, looking at the penalties itself, it is a deterring consequence, I would say, because all we want to see is that we want to deter. We want to deter the level of drink driving in our country to reduce to a certain level that we want to see happen here in the country.
Will this be rolled out just in the capital, Honiara, initially, or is that going to be across the whole of the country?
We've done a Honiara-based, and I'm anticipating that by the end of this year, it will be rolled out into the other 9 provinces. So generally, I would like to see that all RSIPF SWAN members should undergo this or undertake this training by 31st December 2016.
How significant is this law to making the roads safer in Solomon Islands?
Well, the key message here is that we are trying to reduce the behavior of the drivers. That when you're thinking of driving, don't drink. If you're thinking of drinking, don't drive. Because random breath testing can happen anywhere, any place, at any time. And if you're driving and drinking, you'll be caught.
South Bougainville Women MP Isabel Petta believes her region is starting to thrive as it becomes more integrated into the rest of the Papua New Guinea Autonomous Region. Long after the Civil War ended in 1997, strife and violence rendered much of South Bougainville a no-go area. She spoke to Don Wiseman on what has changed.
North and the central Bougainville were able to develop themselves, move on with the activities, normal daily routines. And for us on South, we are slowly getting there. And I must say thank you to the New Zealand government, the police, the New Zealand police that are in Bowen, are based in Bowen. They said they are doing a lot of work, working with the community. Our community policing is now very strong in South Bougainville, and it is really helping the youth in that reason to get up and do something good within the communities.
All of these little factions that are down there, are they being reined in now, and are they starting to behave themselves?
The factions, I must say, they're no threat to elections, because the previous election that we just had, there was nothing that disturbed the elections in South Bougainville. It was very successful. And the government, ABG, is now moving into these factions, talking to them. And we are also at our level going in, talking to these factions to try to come to a common understanding so that we can all be prepared for our referendum come 2019.
Do you think that the people of South Bougainville are committed to wider Bougainville?
We are very committed. And I must say this, with a lot of development now coming in South Bougainville, in Bowen alone, we have just launched the tourism, which shows that law and order in southern part of Bougainville is now being addressed. We have the court system already there. The magistrate is there in Bowen, doing everything to make sure that our people come to normal, and we all now focus ourselves on referendum.
In terms of business developments, what's down there?
The people of South Bougainville, and not only South Bougainville, other parts of Bougainville also that are developing the town. We got a lot of businesses up and running. Before the crisis or before the unrest that we went through, we had only 3 shops in Bowen Town. Now you see a lot of buildings. So many businessmen building their houses, building their shops there.
And it's historically been a very strong farming area, hasn't it? Is that returning?
I am one of those that is really focused on economic empowerment for the people, and I've been working with the cocoa farmers. And I must tell you, on Bougainville, it's the South Bougainville that now has the highest production of cocoa on Bougainville, because Tin Puts is down with the cocoa borer. We are getting ready to host the chocolate festival, which will be held in Bowen Town.
Tell us a little bit about that.
We will be having our 4 chocolate years that will be tasting the chocolate that were collected from different parts of Bougainville.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Vanuatu Red Cross Livelihoods Program is helping young girls who drop out of school learn skills to help them earn a living. Empowering Vanu Malaglo is a local-run residential program which takes 10 to 15 girls for 3 weeks at a time to teach them life skills, including practical income-generating skills like sewing and cooking, as well as reproductive health and civic education. A support officer for the program, Ray Tavoa, said the program has more than 70 young girls who have completed the training since it began in 2014. She said the center continues to provide support for graduates in their communities, even providing them a shopfront for their services. She told Chris Bramwell, "It is very difficult for girls in Vanuatu to make a living once they drop out of school."
This project is all about empowering young women, like giving them another chance to earn a living. They teach them income generating skills, and we also give them awareness about health and all these other stuffs. Even financial literacy and agriculture, we teach them that. We have trainers from other organizations They come in here to train the girls, and then they show them how to earn a living out from...
How many children do you train?
It's 15 girls, each training workshop. And sometimes, due to some reasons, it drops down to 14, 13, then 12. But normally it's not less than 10. It's more than 10. Right. Yes.
And what kind of ages are they?
It's from 16 years up until 20 plus, 21, 22, 23.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. Okay. So do the girls live in here as well for the workshop, or do they just come and visit every day to learn?
They live here. So they come in on Monday and then they go back every Fridays. Yeah.
Okay.
We try to keep them here so that they're more focused and they don't lose interest. Yes. That's why we keep them around here. Mm. We don't let them go. We let them. And we have rules also around this. We have some certain rules which they abide with. And yeah, they are all good girls.
And how do they get to be here? Do their families send them or do the schools decide who should come?
It's normally the dropouts, not the schools. So it's those young girls who have no second chance in going for education and all that. So we normally pick up dropout students. So the girls coming here, they are dropouts. So they are those girls that they just hang around the house with nothing. And then we try to empower them, give them some skills so that they can go back and then they can earn a living out of what we teach them here.
And is it successful? Is it working, do you think?
Yes, very much. It's very much successful. After they go back, they do some of the things they do. They go back and they do some like paper beads, they do cooking and all this. And then some of the products which they think they can sell from the rural areas, they give it to us and then we sell it for them and then we give them back the money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And is it satisfying for you to see them grow and become more confident?
Oh, yes. It's very satisfying. And we are happy that our goal has been met, like we are empowering them. We're giving them other second chances.
Petitions are circulating around the world seeking to save Pacific studies at the Australian National University in Canberra. Faced with an operation shortfall at ANU, the management has decided to cut heavily into the School of Culture, History and Language, with Pacific history suffering significantly. It comes on the back of earlier cuts to the state social and governance program in Melanesia. Recently retired Dr. Bria Lai, who spent 25 years at ANU, told Don Wiseman, "It is one of the strengths that the university has and should not be destroyed."
The School of Culture, History and Language, where most Pacific studies is done, has had to shed 15 positions in the fields of Asia and Pacific studies. But particularly significant impact of that has been on Pacific history. Now, the discipline of Pacific history was founded at ANU in the 1950s, and it is the world's premier center for Pacific historical research. There is no other university in the world which matches ANU in the depth and quality of its research in this field. So I think the future of Pacific history and Pacific studies generally at ANU is in grave danger.
Why has it been done?
This is a mystery. There was financial crisis facing the School of Culture, History and Language, but the nature of the financial difficulties were never really properly explained to the faculty. I don't think that the faculty was taken into confidence in dealing with this issue. So what the university decided was, to save money, they would have to shed 15 positions across the board without really understanding the significance of some areas and the importance of certain positions in certain disciplines, particularly in the field of Pacific history and Pacific studies.
Effectively, the university management no longer values this whole area of Pacific academia.
What they don't fully appreciate is the fact that many people who have devoted their entire lives to Pacific studies at the ANU are concerned. And we are as concerned to protect the reputation of the university and the integrity of the programs that it offers as the management. So I think it's us versus them mentality is hugely counterproductive. Pacific researchers are concerned to find a way forward that does not destroy the foundations of one of the strengths of the ANU. I mean, ANU's distinctive strength is in the area of Asia-Pacific studies. It's the only university in Australia which has such a large cohort of researchers and graduate students. That is its flagship, and I don't really think that that is sufficiently appreciated by the ANU management.
Do you think there's any way back from this? I know there's a number of petitions that are circulating. And as you say, there are these issues as well in other associated areas like the state society and governance. What will happen as a result of those petitions, do you think?
Well, I think the first thing the university has to recognize is that the petition has been signed by people from right across the board and people of great distinction in the field. There is concern widespread across Australia and indeed the world about what is happening at ANU. And I just hope that instead of adopting this us versus them mentality, that the university would listen to the voices of people who are concerned about Pacific studies, who are concerned about ANU's reputation in this field, and who wish ANU all the best, but in a way that the management should work cooperatively with the faculty to identify areas that can be shared, but not the critical part of ANU's Asia-Pacific offering, and that is Pacific studies and Pacific history more specifically.
The arrival of missionaries and consuls and foreign diplomats to Samoa in the mid-18th and early 19th centuries amplified the Samoan language and cultural contact with Western civilization. So how did these contacts change some of the Samoan languages? Well, Maria Tulapaya Taylor spoke to a Samoan studies language lecturer.
A lot of our words, and remember the Bible was translated to Samoan, and so a lot of our words used now are from the Bible, even from the consul occupation of Samoan. But for the consuls, it's more the systems and the ideas they introduced, which we adopted, and what we did, our ancestors did. They try to find words, and they compounded those words, whereas the Bible, most of the words introduced by the Bible and the missionaries were transliterated rather than compounded or finding or using existing words to create a new word. So, interesting dynamics.
Prior to the Christians arriving, there was no written language, or was it all oral?
It was all oral, but then how do we define a written language, I guess? I think for us, Samoans and the Pacific in general, we had our own form. Our languages were written. It's just that not in the Western form of writing, but we had our languages written in our thoughts, our oratory, and all of that. So Western form, yes, not written in that form, but in our own forms.
That sounds quite an amazing feat, considering that they didn't, you know, the missionaries came in, there was no written language, and just to be able to work together to piece it all together.
A very big feat, for example. So the missionaries worked with our ancestors, the elders, to be able to translate. But that's the influence of Christianity in Samoa, where it was well received, and where our ancestors and our people went beyond to be able to translate the Bible as. So that whole transformation, conversion process was rapid. And so, yeah.
And I enjoyed the bit about Samoanizing words, that term you used, as a way too that the language will be able to survive and get stronger in the future.
Yeah, like I mentioned, it's a very powerful concept, Samoanizing words. And in fact, it's, I feel without it, the language may contract. It may not survive without the Samoanizing concept. So I think it's a strength for the Samoan language that our languages were able to accommodate foreign words using the syllable structure, so the consonant vowel structure, whereas most foreign words you have consonants together. But that Samoanizing concept, we insert the vowel in between those to make it a Samoan word. So, very powerful concept, very powerful tool that we have to, I guess, expand the Samoan language and keep it alive and survive.
The veteran Papua New Guinea swimmer Ryan Pina is in the form of his life just months from the Olympics and says no one is more shocked than himself. The 34-year-old retired after the 2012 Olympics in London but returned to the pool to compete at last year's Pacific Games in Port Moresby, where he has won 7 gold medals. He has qualified for 3 events in Rio and told Vinnie Weiler he's looking forward to the forthcoming Olympic Games.
Swimming lifetime personal best in quite a few events, so that's a very good indication of where I'm at. 100 butterfly is my main event, and that one was just a little slower than what I wanted to be. So still working on that at the moment, and the next couple of weeks will sort of give us a good idea of where we're at and what last little changes I can do.
At your age, which in swimming terms is getting on, dare I say, does it surprise you that you can still, push those PB sort of times?
Yeah, it absolutely does. I hit the wall and look at the time and really shake my head in disbelief, because the amount of training that I have done previously in my life before as a younger swimmer as compared to now is nothing in comparison. So, I just wonder what it is that leads to or contributes to all that. But I've got a very well-rounded life and I guess a wealth of experience that I've got, that I know what I can do, what I can't do, and how all that works. So I think that plays into a big part of my success at the moment.
Last year during the Pacific Games and leading up to it, you were based back in PNG, and that was obviously a massive thing for yourself and for the country. Now you're back in Australia, but familiar surroundings, I guess, as well for you?
It was something I had to do to give myself, not so much the facilities, because we've got great facilities there, but it's the coaching and the level of athletes that I swim against here pushes me along. So up in PNG at the moment, it's really very difficult for me to train. I was pretty much myself and 2 other guys. So, it makes a big difference for me coming here. And I've got a lot of people behind me helping me along my journey.
So you qualified for 3 events, the 100 fly being your main one. Are you still looking to compete in all of those, or have you made a decision on that yet?
Not completely yet. We do have another swimmer who equaled the B qualifying time in the 100 freestyle. So I think if he was to be selected on that, I would give him that position in the 100 freestyle. So that gives us a stronger team than we have had before, having 2 qualified swimmers. But to be 100 backstroke, I'll definitely do that. Second half competition, and the 100 butterflies towards the end. So there's plenty of time in between for that stuff and get ready for it.
Off the back of the Pacific Games and, a lot of good performances there, not just in swimming but other sports, what would be a good finish for some of your top athletes?
Making those final rounds or making it through to the next round, I think, for some of those sports, I think that'll be a very good step for them, is to progress through their rounds there. For me, I'd love to be able to make a semi-final again. I believe I can do it. It just comes down to that one day you got to put on everything. So it's going to be a very intense couple of weeks.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you wish to contact us, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.